Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and in this edition, I'm joined by the two Sams, Samantha Morton and Sam Riley, stars of the beautiful Joy Division biopic Control. I also talk sons, fathers and memories with director Anand Tucker, whose moving adaptation of And When Did You Last See Your Father hits the screens this week. But cast your minds back, please, to the late 1970s, when the north of England existed in black and white, or that's how it seems, at any rate, in Control, a new film about the short life of Joy Division's lead singer, Ian Curtis. The film was a hit at the Cannes Film Festival, whence I brought you its first review and the very first interview with newcomer Sam Riley, whose performance as Curtis is quite remarkable. Control has since earned praise at festivals and from the hard-to-please music press, from that core group who hold the doom and gloom rock of that Manchester indie scene so dear. Anton Corbin, the Dutch photographer of many bands such as Joy Division and U2, of course, is now making his film debut and captures the era and mood with accuracy and sympathy, using gorgeous monochrome photography to portray a grim Britain, but still a hopeful and beautiful one.
Do you want to sleep with other men?
What?
Do you want to sleep with other men?
That's a strange question.
Because if you did, it'd be okay. I'd be okay.
Are you being serious? When you say a thing like that, it makes me think you don't love me anymore.
I don't think I do. Taking your medication. But it's worse.
Do you know? Could be worse. Could be the lead singer in the Fall.
The film was based on the book Touching from a Distance by Curtis's wife Deborah, a character played in the film by that most instinctive of British actresses, Samantha Morton. I met up with the two Sams, and first, let's hear from Samantha Morton.
You've been working so hard, though. Has that been difficult?
No, I wrapped a movie. I wrapped Charlie Kaufman's film in New York about 6 weeks ago. And it's fine. You know, I'm a young woman and... As women, we work when we're pregnant. We just get on with it.
Yeah. This is your second one, of course, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, does the kind of movie world take a backseat when something like this is about to happen?
Yeah, a little bit. But then I took some time off a while. I did, like, 8 films back-to-back, and then I took nearly 2 years off, and then because I was writing and stuff, and then being with my daughter, because I just thought this is crazy. And she just started big school and everything, and then just, you know, kind of wanting some normality, and then I did another 5 films, and now they're all coming out, which is good, because they're all going to be coming out and have you there with the baby at home, and yeah. And then I'll go back to work again, and it'll be good.
So that's how you can pile them up, and it looks like you're kind of working all the way through, and they're thinking, how's she done that? Yeah. People don't kind of divorce the reality from the fiction.
It takes a while. An interviewer just said to me, when you were holding the baby in the film, were you pregnant then? I said, we made the film nearly, gosh, well over a year and a half ago now, you know?
It doesn't, because you're just there, so you've been pregnant. Yeah. You can be pregnant for months and months.
And at the BAFTA screening last night, I was pregnant in the film, and then I come up and I'm like wobbling on the stage, and okay.
And does Esme, your daughter, know what's going on there?
She's very excited. She's going to have a brother or sister. Very exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Well, anyway, your birthing in reality is another matter. You're giving birth to Control at the moment, which I think is. It's a fantastic movie, and you seem to be very involved in Control. I mean, it's very much... I know it's based on the book of your character, isn't it?
Yeah. The book is called Touching from a Distance, and Deborah Curtis wrote it, kind of like the memoirs of her relationship with Ian. And at that time, and in the 70s, I suppose, the music industry in Macclesfield wasn't really happening, and just their struggles to just even make a record, let alone an album, and her... You know, spending all the money, the rent money on the equipment in the studio being in the house, and it'd been very, very exciting as well. And obviously the book is quite epic because it goes all the way from the beginning of their relationship to, you know, his unfortunate death. And you, For those of you out there that don't know, sorry, just like gave
you've ruined the ending.
The ending of the film away. Eek.
It's all right.
Sorry.
I think it's all right.
But and then when Anton came to make the film, you've got, you know, it's about Ian, and I think that a lot of the other stuff has to kind of just support it. And I think that in a film like this, I was desperate to play Debbie, and I'd had a relationship with Anton Corbin prior to this. I did a U2 video for him.
Is this the one?
Storm, with Larry Mullen in the bath.
Yes. Because you do a lot of things, stuff in the bath. It was kind of after Minority Report when people thought, oh, that
yeah,
wet
but that
look.
Was a little pool, wasn't it? It wasn't really a bath.
No, but it's the wet look. Samantha Wharton in wet. Like Esther Williams, you are.
Who's Esther Williams?
She was
should I know that?
The Hollywood star of Busby Berkeley movies.
Oh, I wish I was Esther Williams.
And they always said to her, they always said about her, she was beautiful. Because
right.
When she wasn't in Busby Berkeley movies, she was terrible.
Oh, right.
So,
Please don't say I'm like that.
No, you're not.
No, but yes, I was. I had this relationship with Anton, that's what I was talking about, and he really sweetly was thinking of me, and I had been a really good friend of mine, Juliet Lath, who was a producer, and she was working with him on something, and I said to her, when I did the video for Anton, it was like working with a film director. I cannot believe he hasn't shot film. He's done videos that are incredible and really iconic, and you know the one that we're here talking about in a way today prior to the film is the re-release of the Joy Division song, you know, the video where they're carrying his thing down and all the people have got the in Spain, and anyway, he did that, and it's just one of those videos that it just blows your mind.
So you're quite into your music, aren't you?
Yeah, in a big way. When I grew up, the music I was into when I kind of got into things, and you know, like 1990, was more like a DJ and a field with 3,000 people in it, and we worshipped DJs in a way. And if you could get into some bonkers DIY party and get on a bus somewhere to, you know, to a weird underground club, and I was kind of into records and bands, but I wasn't. It was more about rave for me, age whatever. And then so when I was a bit older, I suppose about 19, I was living in New York, and a friend of mine had done a mixtape for me, and a lot of the Smiths were on there, and Joy Division, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'd heard their music before, but it didn't really affect me. And then now it did, and I went and bought this Heart and Soul, this big compilation, and used it for all my work. I was just there,
Are you like your character in Morven Callow when he's got the constant soundtrack?
Yeah, music means a lot. You said music means a lot to me, and it does. I can't work without it. I think, you know, some films will be awful without their soundtracks. You know, you know what I mean? Film and sound are so special together, I think.
Samantha Morton there, who plays Deborah Curtis in the film Control. Her co-star is Sam Riley, who makes an extraordinary debut in Control. His performance as Ian Curtis earned raves at Cannes and now seems to have earned a young man who was not so long ago folding shirts in a Leeds warehouse a career as an actor. Samantha Morton there, who plays Deborah Curtis in the film Control. Her co-star is Sam Riley, who makes an extraordinary debut in Control. His performance as Ian Curtis earned raves at Cannes and now seems to have earned a young man who was not so long ago folding shirts in a Leeds warehouse a career as an actor.
It was after Cannes when I came back to London, then I went and was still auditioning as I had been the whole year before, but all of a sudden I was getting a cup of tea in 5 minutes instead of two in the rooms and things. I mean, I'm still getting rejected, obviously, but I'm getting a few more. I'm getting a bit closer.
You're getting better at handling
the rejections. I'm getting better at handling my rejections, yeah.
But life for you is good. I mean, you moved to Berlin last time we spoke.
Still loved up.
And you're still in Berlin?
Yeah.
And that's treating you well?
Yeah, I love it there.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
You're getting better at the job.
Yeah, no, clap.
Let's just talk about Control.
Okay, yeah.
You are in it.
Yeah.
And your relationship with Samantha Morton in it, both on screen and now you're doing this kind of circus off it. Because, I mean, you know, you've been in Edinburgh, you've been in Cannes, she didn't come to Cannes, but Edinburgh and here now. Because on screen you have a remarkably strong chemistry, the two Sams.
Amazing.
Which is, you know, was that something that just happened and it is just a remarkable kind of feat of casting?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know, she can probably play with a guy she hates and make it look like she likes him. I don't know, she's that good. But we got on really well. I don't know, she helped me a lot really and Anton. I mean, he knew what he was doing. I'm not going to slag him off that much, but she definitely helped. No, I don't know. Chemistry's just chemistry, I guess. we got on well with each other. And I was frightened when she was shouting at me.
Yeah.
I mean, it was...
You would be.
Yeah.
So when you say she actually sort of helped you, I mean, she's vast experience, but the way she works herself, she's very intuitive. She was a kind of force of nature when she first came on our screens years ago, when in, like, your Crackers, etc.
Yeah.
How did she actually sort of help you with in terms of advice, blocking?
Well, not... I don't know. She just... We put down the script quite a few times and just knew what the idea of the scene was. And then she just said, well, why don't we just do it and just have a... Just talk to me as if you're Ian and I'm Debbie. So I said, okay, try that then. Wow, that feels good, doesn't it? That was almost realistic. And she's very professional and, you know, and she's tough, which is good, you know, especially for a woman on set. It's more harder for the actresses, really, I think. They get a harder time. So she has to be strong. But yeah, I loved her. She's great.
And the lessons that you've probably learned here, are you going to take them forward, or are you going to have to unlearn certain things?
I don't know. Every character's going to be different now, I hope.
Well, it could be very
similar. I'm not going to play in again. Control 2, The Haunting, yeah.
Anton Corbijn's Control is a striking debut, a mix of cool style and anguished youth. It could do with a bit more pace and perhaps a bit more humour. The most enjoyable moments come courtesy of Toby Kibble's neat turn as the band manager Rob Cretton. But you can't fault it for atmosphere and a genuine sense of place. And both Sams in the lead roles are riveting actors you can't help but watch. Director Anand Tucker hit the big time with Hilary and Jackie, his terrific portrait of cellist Jacqueline Dupre, which earned Oscar nominations for his actresses Emily Watson and Rachel Griffiths. He went on to co-produce the similarly successful Girl with a Pearl Earring before travelling to Hollywood to work with Steve Martin on the adaptation of the comedian's novella Shop Girl, which starred Jason Schwartzman, Claire Danes and Martin himself. Tucker was then slated to direct The Golden Compass, a huge budgeted version of Philip Pullman's bestseller. But despite devoting vast amounts of time and skill to the project, the studio suddenly got scared, and Anand was replaced at the final moment by American director Chris Weitz. The next day, a very different script landed on Anand's desk. It was a version of Blake Morrison's memoir, And When Did You Last See Your Father? And the result now arrives in cinemas, featuring a rollicking performance from Jim Broadbent as a country doctor. His son, whose memoir it is played by Colin Firth as he wrestles with his strained relationship with this affable monster. I met up with Anand Tucker in a London bookshop to leaf through the process of taking an intimate book to the big screen and to sift through The Colour of Memories. I'm with Anand Tucker, director of the film with the longest title this year, And When Did You Last See Your Father, is out in your cinemas this week. Congratulations on your film, Anand. Is it the longest title that you've ever worked with, surely?
Oh, yeah. Terms and conditions apply, I think.
It's been shortened in all the emails I've got to... I would just go for film.
Yes. Well, in America, they took a good, hard, long look at it and dropped the "and."
Okay.
So, you know, our integrity is safely in place.
But, I mean, it's obviously not your fault. It's the memoir on which it was based, Blake Morrison's memoir. It's a book that I read when it first came out, and it was never something that occurred to me would make a film at all.
Well, I have to confess, as I did to Blake just recently, that I hadn't read it when it first came out. And, in fact, I mean, I knew all about it. I knew all about Blake, but the book that I'd read at the time was Fever Pitch. Mm. Being an ardent Arsenal season ticket holder, and I actually tried to option that book, but Mr. Hornby wouldn't give it to me. But so when I read the script, it really moved me. It made me cry, which happens very rarely. And then I read Blake's book, and that made me cry again. So, you know, have to have a go, I think, under those circumstances.
Yeah, the delicateness of the book is that it's very much a personal memoir, and I've always assumed that was very difficult to adapt to the screen, and I think that's what your film's feat is to personalise it and yet dramatise it too.
Well, I think David Nichols, who wrote the screenplay, did a really good job of excavating out of an incredibly internal series of recollections a narrative of sorts. You know, I mean, it doesn't have car chases or gunfights or anything like that, but, you know, it does have a mystery at the heart of the story and an unfolding series of events. And for me, like, the most visual sequence in the movie is the sequence where the father and son go on this journey and end up on a beach, with this driving lesson on a beach. And if you look at Blake's book, that's half a sentence, you know. But right there, it's interesting. You know, David found one little nugget of something, and out of that, he sort of, created this wonderful cinematic scene. And so David did a lot of that hard work.
Yes, you're right, because when I saw the film, I was like, I don't remember this happening at all. I mean, it took a quite long time for the book to make it to the screen. But I also know there's an interesting story behind you getting involved in it as well. You weren't the sort of attached from the off here, were you?
No, I only came onto the project in August of last year, and we were shooting within 3 months, but they'd been developing the movie for about 8 years beforehand, so...
What were you up to?
I was involved in a Hollywood adventure. I was working on the Golden Compass.
The huge Golden Compass, Philip Pullman Golden Compass.
That's right, the huge Philip Pullman Golden Compass, and... Things didn't work out, so, you know, but I was very lucky that Stephen Woolley and Liz Carlson, the producers, sent me the script the day after I was no longer doing The Golden Compass.
Wow, I mean, they're two extraordinary... I imagine I haven't seen The Golden Compass, obviously, but I imagine they're two extraordinarily different projects. One kind of very British and 60s and very kind of set in the everyday, or a world that you and I understand, and then there's this kind of weird fantasy world. Are you a weird fantasy world kind of guy?
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, I've loved those Philip Pullman books, though, since they first came out back in 96, the first one, 97. But, you know, the beauty of Philip's books is that they're very, very English. Mm. And, you know, I love Englishness. I'm actually not English. I'm German, and my father's Indian. But I've lived here a long time, and I find something about England and Englishness utterly compelling, as a lot of foreigners sort of do who've settled here, I think.
You're not that foreign, Anna. After all, you do support Arsenal. Although they're probably French, aren't they?
Yeah.
What I do like about And When Did You Last See Your Father is the quintessential Englishness of it. And I think that Colin Firth's character's difficulty with his father is a very English problem. And the fact that his father is such an English gentleman. Mm.
I think that there's an emotional range that it plays in. You know, that's a particular kind of thing which I think... I don't know how that works around the world in some ways, you know, if it's not taking place in the kind of country house or pretty castle world of England that people like to consume that kind of thing in, you know. I remember when Hilary and Jackie, which is a film I made a few years ago, was also a very English movie about English emotions, played at the Venice Film Festival. It had its world premiere there, and the best review the next morning in the Italian press said, "This movie stinks worse than the Venice canals at the height of summer." And all I remember in that screening, which was the world premiere, okay, I'm sitting there, was that wherever they were meant to laugh, there was utter silence. Wherever they were meant to, you know, be crying or take it seriously, they were laughing. So I sort of thought, well, it's funny, this English emotion thing, it maybe doesn't translate so well, you know.
Maybe those Italians have got, they have a strange sense of it. But the music with that film was so beautiful. And anyway, what did they know? It went all the way to the Oscars.
What do they know, exactly?
And when you ask your father, you have, I think, a difficult task in making such a film, in that you want to kind of pull on the heartstrings, if you like, but you want to also pull back, because it's about both reticence and kind of gushing at the same time. It's about that kind of the moment the floodgates open.
Yeah, and that's the hardest thing to do with a film like this. And I think the truth of the matter is, it'll work for some people and it won't work for others. You know, it's a sort of film that actually is more about holding a mirror up to your own emotions, and you'll respond or not depending on where you're at. And I have a particular taste, and it's a taste thing. You know, I like a certain amount of music on films, and I've had the gamut of responses, from people who have been utterly undone and weeping to people who've gone, "Well, my father died 3 weeks ago. I watched your movie. I felt nothing." You know, and you know, reviewers have said, you know, it's incredibly powerful and very moving. And others have said, "Oh, it's really cold and unemotional." You know, and some people love the movie. Some people hate it. You know what? When you're dealing in this kind of film, which is purely, it's an emotional response you're looking for, and it comes down to a matter of taste, I think, because it's not a genre film. It's not doing the moves like a thriller. Mm. You know, a good thriller, you sort of can tell if it's working because it's doing its moves, you know, and what can you do with a movie like this, you know? And that's fine. That's fine. That's what these films are. You're not going to please everybody.
There were moments in it, if I get personal with you, there were moments that did affect me very much, and then there were moments where it didn't work for me as well. And I think that there are some beautiful kind of skills that you employed to kind of always remind us that what we're dealing here is memory, which I think is one of the hardest things to evoke on film. You've got kind of these kind of lachrymose wipes that come across the screen. Is that your idea? Have you nicked that from somewhere?
Well, no, I mean, I would imagine pretty much every trick in that film has been nicked from something I've seen somewhere, you know. I have no claims to any originality. I'll steal from, you know, wherever I can. You know, I watched Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love obsessively before making it, and so there's a lot of mirror shots in it, obviously.
And that's a film that kind of gets into the blood by feeling and by sensuality as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just think it's very difficult when you're dealing with emotion, with, like, death, and the death of your own parents, which is what the film is trying to make you think about. It's very difficult to... I'll not get that right, my own take on it, for you all the time. Maybe not at all, maybe sometimes, you know. Because sometimes, if you're feeling something, you don't want to have music where I've put it, or... You know what I mean? I don't know, I think it's difficult with films like this, but I think that, in the end, and I don't mean this to sound selfish, all you can do is please yourself. You know, I made a movie in the end that pleased myself, because in the end I had so many different reactions. The only audience I could ultimately try and make it work for was me, you know, and I'm a particular kind of person, you know.
It's a boy thing though, isn't it, the father-son relationship. They often sort of say that Hollywood's always about fathers and sons. Spielberg's work's about fathers and sons. How would, although it's never really dealt with them in quite a sort of as personal way as this, it's slightly more abstract, I think, but this one actually makes it kind of concrete, that kind of father and son bonding, and it's very anti-Hollywood, I would say.
Well,
counter-Hollywood.
A film I thought about a lot was The Searchers. John Ford's right. Searchers, and that was my model. You know, I felt this was like an interior epic journey, you know, and the Western squarely is mainly about the father-son relationship, yeah. Over and over and over again, you know, fathers who've left, fathers who failed, fathers who are, you know, and sons trying to resolve. And so I thought a lot about Westerns when I was making this film, you know. So there are a lot of Hollywood movies that are sort of obliquely about that relationship or have sort of genre ways of dealing with it, but very few do the Douglas Sirk thing of taking it head on in the way that Douglas Sirk would take women's weepies straight on, you know? And there aren't that many that do that, I don't think. You know, I look at this as a kind of male Douglas Sirk movie. You know, it's a male weepy chick flick or something, I don't know.
What were the actual kind of the stories from the shoot? Let's go back to that. Where did you do it, and what? I mean, it must have been fun with Jim Broadbent. I mean, I imagine he enlivens any shoot.
Well, actually, you know what? Jim is the shyest man on earth. The shyest man on earth. And the sweetest shyest man on earth. And really, he just wants to do his crossword. So Jim basically will wander onto set, be buried in his crossword pretty much all day long, other than when he's talking to Jim Greenhorn, the sound guy, who once upon a time wrote the hit single Whoa, 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 It's Magic. Do you know that song?
I
can't remember the name of the band. Anyway, our sound guy, Jim Greenhorn, wrote it, so it's a terribly sad story about what happened to Jim and the royalties on that song. But anyway, so Jim would either be doing his crossword or discussing royalties that were never arrived with Jim, and that was it. Colin, you know, we'd discuss Macintosh issues a lot, because he's a computer geek, basically. We just had a nice time. It wasn't particularly... It was very English. I mean, the highlight was probably there was a three-day period where the group of us, including the DP, spent a lot of time discussing the various merits of different kinds of plastic bags from Tesco's and Asda's and Safeway's and Sainsbury's. That kept us going for a while.
Yeah, I can imagine. And your final answer?
I think we decided the Safeway bag was the best one.
You don't see enough of them anymore. No. That classic stripe. No. I can see how this...
It's all Morrison's now anyway,
yeah,
isn't it?
Especially up north. Yeah. Where was that house? I mean, beautiful country house.
Well, the thing is, although the movie's all set in Yorkshire, supposedly, we had to shoot it all in Derbyshire because they gave us some money. So it's about half an hour outside of Derby, that whole beautiful West Ridings area. It's very beautiful.
I mean, I think there are moments in the film that everyone will identify. You mentioned the car journey there. It made me think of my first driving lesson with my dad.
Did you give you yours?
Oh, yeah, of course he did. Oh, okay. I completely drove off the road, forgot to stop, drove onto the golf course and ended up on the first green.
Good!
So it totally reminded me of that.
Was he nice to you? Or?
He didn't mind, I think. Okay. I think he was a bit annoyed that the golf course was turned up. He thought it was terribly bad etiquette.
And when did you last see your father?
Luckily, I see my father a lot, actually. Right. I'm very, very pleased about that. But the question that remains at the end of Blake's memoir and the end of your film is actually, actually seeing one's father. There's one's father, the person, and there's actually kind of getting there. And there are moments where you think, well, you know what, I need to actually sit down and have a proper chat with them. When did you ever chat to your dad? I mean, it's usually the one about the birds and the bees, they say, but I've never even had that chat with him about that.
I'd love to have, like, the chat with my dad, you know, but I don't think it'll ever happen because we are who we are, do you know what I mean? And I think that's sort of what the film is about, because actually it's, you know, what it's trying to deal with is the fact that it's generally always too late to have that conversation, because a lot of time it's impossible. And so what do you do when it is too late, and how do you deal with that? And that's what the film's sort of about, you know.
I think it's a film that repays second view. My first viewing, I didn't get moved so much. The second viewing, I thought much more came out of it. It's a very gently nuanced film, as it has to be, because you're dealing really with the colour and the shades of memory here.
You saw it twice, you brave soul.
I get paid for it.
Good. It's like I said, you know, it's like it's a bit like a painting or a tone poem for me, you know. And I don't mean, listen, it's an okay night out at the cinema, you know. It's got laughs and it's got some good performances and all that, but it's more about a feeling and a kind of it's searching for some kind of, not to be pretentious about it, but it is searching for some kind of deeper truth about the human condition. Blah, blah, blah.
Well, the male condition, I kind of feel very... I know the women are shouting out to it, but I did feel it very... made me want to go to football with my father, which I will do very soon.
Yeah. So, do you know, I don't know. I hope it finds its place in the world. Mm. You know.
And just to very briefly, we glad to have you back here shooting in the UK. Obviously, you were going to do a huge project with the Golden Compass, then this little one came along. We lost you to Hollywood for a little bit there when you went off to shoot Shop Girl with Steve Martin, which I thought was, again, didn't find its place in the world, but I thought that was also a very lovely film as well.
About a lost thing.
Yeah, but it was rather gorgeous, I thought.
It was very personal to Steve, and, you know, again, it's that slightly off-kilter thing about, because it's based on what really happened to Steve, even though the novella is supposedly a work of fiction, you know. It's kind of about imperfect people struggling to make connections in a world, and I'm really fond of that movie. I mean, it's, you know, it's got things about it that work and things about it that don't, but I think, you know, I won more than I lost, and I, you know, Hollywood was fun, it was great.
And so it's all a learning curve for you, I take it, Anna, but you're back here now and living here. Mm-hmm. What are you lined up next?
Well, I'm producing my wife's movie Incendiary at the moment, so we're a bit of a household, which is entertaining.
This is a film with Ewan McGregor, isn't it?
That's right, with Ewan McGregor and Michelle Williams, directed by Sharon Maguire, who did Bridget Jones' Diary, the first one. So it's a laugh riot.
It's set in the UK, though, isn't it?
It's set in England, and it's about suicide bombers who blow up Highbury Stadium, Jason.
Oh, don't you start.
What can I say? So it'll be very popular up the other side of Finsbury Park, I'm sure. I don't know what I'm going to do next. You know, I'd love to... I'd be lucky if I get to make another film, and I hope I get to do that, whether that's here or in America, you know. Who knows?
Well, I wish you luck. It's a great calling card, and when did you last see your father? I wish you the best of luck with it, and I hope, as you say, it does find its audience this weekend. Anand Tucker, thanks very much.
Thank you, Jason.
Anand Tucker there, director of And When Did You Last See Your Father? And When Did You Last See Your Father is a stylish, somewhat restrained film, a tasteful one indeed. As Tucker himself admits, there are times when it almost doesn't go far enough. Broadbent isn't exactly the Pete Postlethwaite bullying dad character of Distant Voices, Still Lives, say, so Firth occasionally looks a bit of a softy. But there are also some very droll, acutely observed emotional moments that are extremely well handled by the director. Now that we're all in touch with our soft sides, might I remind you of a treacly film out this week called Feast of Love. It stars Morgan Freeman in wise voiceover mode, but thankfully there are neither penguins nor prisoners in sight here. Morgan plays a tired professor in picturesque Portland, Oregon, taking a sabbatical to get over the death of his son. We meet the various characters he bumps into, including Greg Kinnear's coffee shop owner, who doesn't notice that his wife, Selma Blair, is falling in love with a very beautiful softball player. Left for a lesbian, Greg quickly falls in love with a neurotic estate agent, played with sinewy sexiness by Rada Mitchell. She, in turn, is having an affair with a married man. Meanwhile, Kinnear's shop assistant, Oscar, has just fallen head over heels in cappuccino froth with a beautiful girl who's looking for a job in a fetching pair of denim hot pants. She gets way more than a job, I might add. So what we've got is an American quilt of love here, with all its heartache, joy, and a surprising amount of sex. It's directed by Robert Benton, who did Kramer vs. Kramer in the 70s and was the original writer of Bonnie and Clyde. But it looks like they've got the wrong Robert here. Altman would have been the one to give the Strands a deadly comic acidity that's missing. Still, there's plenty of aphoristic musing from Freeman about the nature and randomness of life and love, and there are some attractive performances too, with plenty of handsome film craftsmanship on display, as well as that signature note of all ageing directors, loads of young females taking their kit off. Call me old-fashioned or just a romantic, but I rather liked it. It certainly beats the wobbly camera, flashy editing and dodgy jingoism of The Kingdom, which stars Jamie Foxx and Jennifer Garner kicking some serious Arab ass in Saudi Arabia. A film I would avoid if I were you, mainly because it's very slick at papering over its macho posturing and bellicose intentions. It's a film which says, hey, look how we understand Arab customs. Look at how we got their hierarchy right, their national dress, the research we did into their ways. And now watch how we kill them all. I know Jamie Foxx played Ray Charles once, but hey, Jamie, you can open your eyes to read the scripts first, mate. Anyway, that brings us to a close for another week. Film Weekly was produced by Paul Noble. I've been Jason Solomons, and until next time, we wish you happy viewing. And if you do see your dad, give him a hug.